Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest.
Welcome to Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. I'm Nick Champeau in Paris. Coming up in the program, Romania's president comfortably survives a referendum to impeach him, but he's in hot water again for calling a journalist a gypsy. We'll have a report from Bucharest. A close aide to Nicolas Sarkozy takes a top position at France's most popular TV station. And the new president comes under flak.
It's a very bad signal because it gives the impression that even the private media in this country are under direct control from the presidency.
Transborder phone calls will be cheaper soon as the EU agrees to slash roaming rates. Bad news for mobile phone operators, good news for citizens, says our EU insider Stephen Castle in Brussels.
At the end of the day, the legislators have come down in favour of giving a clear signal to voters that the EU is trying to make life easier for the man and woman in the street.
We'll go to Sweden, where mainstream politicians receive special training to debate with far-right and often racist candidates. And we'll also head south to Spain, where expats are no longer spectators in the political arena. All that and more in this week's Network Europe, so stay tuned. But first to our top story. The president of Romania, Traian Băsescu, survived an impeachment referendum. On May 19th, Romanians decided to go on with their popular reformist president. He was suspended a month ago by a parliamentary majority on allegations that he violated the constitution. Radio Romania's Iulian Murasan reports from Bucharest.
That was University Square in Bucharest at the end of a long day, the day of the referendum for the impeachment of President Traian Băsescu. People gather here spontaneously every time they feel they have something to say. This time, almost 75% of those who voted on Saturday said no to the impeachment procedure initiated by a parliamentary majority.
I'm here to support justice and to fight for democracy and freedom, no matter who runs Romania. Băsescu is our symbol today, and they should acknowledge that we need justice, justice and justice.
I'm here to celebrate. 17 years ago, on May the 13th, I was beaten up here in this square, so that I spent 90 days in hospital. Here, I can always express myself.
This square is the symbol of the anti-communist fight. I have great confidence in what will follow.
After he's been confirmed in office by 75% of those who turned out to the vote, Traian Băsescu goes before Parliament with renewed legitimacy.
I would like to assure you that I'll do everything in my powers for the parliamentary parties to respect your vote. What no one can ask from me is to negotiate your aspirations, to negotiate the aspirations of the Romanians who live in a modern country, a new Romania, different from that which was built and consolidated in the transition period. Nobody wants an oligarchic Romania, nobody except them.
But at least for another year and a half, that is, until the next elections, President Băsescu will have to put up with the same parliamentary majority that suspended him a month ago. The MPs who voted to suspend the president are now open to collaboration. Prime Minister Călin Popescu-Tăriceanu.
I respect the vote and I will support a collaboration between the government and the president to the benefit of Romania.
Mircea Joana is the president of the Social Democratic Party in the opposition.
This vote tells us to work with Mr. Traian Băsescu on the basis of the present constitution of Romania. No other interpretation is possible and acceptable by us and the people who love democracy.
There might be, however, a different interpretation of the result of this referendum, but the 322 MPs who initiated the impeachment procedure are not very keen on acknowledging it. This interpretation would be the following. 75% of the Romanians who voted on Saturday for Băsescu voted equally against the 322 MPs who suspended him.
That was Radio Romania's Julian Murasan. And Romania's Anti-Discrimination Council on Wednesday issued a warning to President Traian Băsescu for calling a journalist a dirty gypsy. And now to Paris, where French President Nicolas Sarkozy's ties to business and media came under fresh attack this week after his former deputy campaign director took on a top post at the country's most popular television station, TF1. The owner of the channel, billionaire Martin Bouygues, is a close friend of Sarkozy. He is the godfather of one of his sons. Earlier on, critics were concerned by the decision made by the Journal du Dimanche newspaper not to publish an article revealing that Sarkozy's wife, Cecilia, did not vote in the second round presidential poll. The newspaper is owned by another Sarkozy friend. Radio France International's Jan van der Made reports.
The objectivity of the French press is at stake. After the appointment of Laurent Soli, former campaign manager with the current president Nicolas Sarkozy as director of TF1, criticism on the way the new president is dealing with the press has been mounting. I first asked Axel Poniatowski, member of parliament for the ruling party UMP, what signal he thinks the appointment of Mr. Soli gives.
It's really mainly a personnel choice from here and for his career. First of all, TF1 is a private company, so it is managed under rules of private business. And secondly, Laurent Soli is a very talented young man who's making the choice to go in the private sector rather than to continue in the public sector. He has been with Nicolas Sarkozy for 4 years as his cabinet director, and he's just making the choice to go in private business. There is just absolutely nothing abnormal in this situation.
French media watchdog Reporters Without Borders signals a growing discontent among the public with the media.
It is one of the reasons why French citizens today don't really trust the media. Half of the people in France don't really trust the media because they have the feeling that there are some very close links between political leaders and journalists, seeing the fact that journalists start to work with the government and former people belongs to political parties are now involved in very high level responsibilities in some very important media. But we think that it is to the media to determine what they can accept and what they can't.
But is it? President Sarkozy is good friends with many of the French media moguls, and one phone call by the president just might be enough to stop a story. Pierre Aski, a former journalist with left-wing newspaper Libération, founded his own website for independent journalism called Rue 89, or Road Number 89. He found out that a newspaper owned by a friend of Sarkozy, Le Journal du Dimanche, did not print a story which said that the wife of the president did not vote. A case of censorship, one might say, but again, what signal does it give to the public?
It's a very bad signal because it gives the impression that even the private media in this country are under direct control from the presidency. And that's the image that has been spread all over the campaign. When the owner of one of the biggest media groups in this country describes the president as his brother, when this owner of a newspaper censors his own newspaper because it has embarrassing reports about the wife of the president, that is really bad. And when it touches the biggest channel in the country, with the number two of the channel coming straight from the staff of the president, I think this is quite unacceptable and quite shocking for the spirit of freedom of speech in this country.
As a result of Sarkozy's strong links with top media owners, France's Communist Party is talking about the Berlusconization of the French media. I asked Axel Poniatowski what he thought of this.
I really think that this point is quite absurd. Excuse me of the formula, but Berlusconi owns all his TV and radio channels. Nicolas Sarkozy doesn't own anything, so we are in two completely different situations.
Well, maybe as a result of all the criticism, two journalists who were married to newly appointed ministers will change the nature of their job. Christine Ocran, a star journalist with France's third channel, is married to Bernard Kouchner, Minister of Foreign Affairs, and Béatrice Schönberg, a presenter with France's second channel, is the wife of Finance Minister Jean-Louis Borloo. Both women announced they won't do politically sensitive programs anymore.
And thanks to RFI's Jan van der Made for that report on the media and politics. Well, now let's focus on expats and politics. There are local elections being held in Spain this weekend, and there are some unexpected candidates, namely from the country's large expat community. For more than a decade, European Union citizens have had the right to vote and stand as candidates in local elections in any EU country if they live there as residents. Until now, these expats have been keeping relatively quiet, but that's no longer the case. In Spain, for the first time, independent political parties with more non-Spanish than Spanish candidates are taking part in local elections. Deutsche Welle's Danny Wood reports from the town of San Fulgencio in the province of Alicante.
Living the good life in Spain, a group of British expats enjoy a boating trip off the coast of Alicante. Since the 1960s, the attraction of a more relaxed and affordable lifestyle has made Spain a top destination for northern Europeans who live abroad. There are about 1.5 million expats living in Spain, most of them British and German. Now this sun and fun is not enough. Expats are entering the choppy waters of local Spanish politics. In the run-up to the elections on the 27th of May, a number of local parties are dominated by expats. One of them is the Independent Mediterranean Party, AIM. 11 of AIM's 13 political candidates are non-Spanish Europeans, mainly British. Mick Blake is British and he's the vice president.
Spain has progressed wonderfully well over the last 30 years. Local politicians haven't. They're stuck in a time warp and they're not listening to the fact that people now are saying it's time for a change, we need to advance.
A lot of non-Spaniards think, rightly or wrongly, that they're ignored by Spain's established political parties, but they're also entering politics to solve serious problems. One of the biggest is corruption in urban planning. Thousands of people who own houses, Spaniards and expats, many recently constructed along the coast, are in danger of losing their homes to bulldozers because without their knowledge, their homes were built illegally. Expats are calling for sustainable development, rather than the continuous construction that has destroyed much of Spain's coast. There's also concern about basic issues like getting more health centres and better public transport for urban areas dominated by expats. And there are now more younger expats resident in Spain, many with children. They see getting involved in politics as a normal part of living in their adopted home. Like British national Anne Bray.
I think it's more an evolution. You know, times change, people change, everything changes slowly, but it will change.
Anne, like Mick, is a candidate for AIM, one of about half a dozen local parties like GRIP and Nueva Javier, with expats on their lists competing for seats in the municipality of San Fulgencio, south of the city of Alicante. The resident population here is about 11,000, more than half are British, followed by Spaniards and then Germans. So if old national sympathies mean anything and convert into votes, you'd think the local Spanish mayor, Mariano Martí Sánchez, would be running scared. He's not.
It's a positive thing that everyone in San Fulgencio participates actively in our political life. It's a good thing that the Europeans here are involving themselves in political parties. It will be good for the whole society.
The mayor says he's accustomed to catering for a large population of non-Spaniards and rejects the concerns about urban planning, for example, that expats partly blame on his council. As I leave the council, I notice that the council's monthly bulletin is in Spanish, English and German. In the town square of San Fulgencio, José Manuel says everyone has the right to express their ideas and their nationality is not important. This is a wonderful thing, he says. The local butcher, Eusebio, agrees. But there is one thing that concerns him. Expats with poor Spanish language skills having to communicate their political decisions in the local language. Spain has seen lots of political changes over the last three decades, including a transition from dictatorship to democracy and joining the European Union. This new phenomenon of expats getting significantly involved in local Spanish politics is seen by many here as another step that improves and deepens their democracy. Danny Wood, Deutsche Welle Radio, in San Fulgencio, in the province of Alicante.
You're listening to Network Europe. Still on the issue of politics, national politics this time, how should one debate with far-right and often racist extremists? It's a sticky issue that politicians across Europe are having to ponder with the entry of far-right parties into mainstream politics. Sweden's far-right party, the Sweden Democrats, burst into the limelight after success in the country's regional elections last autumn. They held their annual conference last weekend. And while not so long ago the event might have only recorded a minor headline or two, these days the anti-immigrant party is big news. So much so that the country's politicians are now not only engaging in public debate with the party, they're receiving tips on how to do it. Radio Sweden's Dave Russell reports.
From no news to big news, the Sweden Democrat Party has enjoyed a high profile since winning 2.9% of the vote in last September's general election. From live television debates with Social Democrat leader Mona Sahlin to newspaper headlines about venues in Sweden refusing to stage a congress for a party with far-right views. Well, the Sweden Democrats' annual congress did go ahead on Swedish soil over the weekend in Karlskrona, 200 delegates meeting inside, while demonstrations by the Social Democrat youth wing SSU went on outside. Jimmy Åkesson was re-elected as leader, and not surprisingly, the issue of immigration was top of the new party programme, with stricter requirements for Swedish citizenship and moving here for people with family ties. Protecting Swedish traditions and values, the Folkhemmet was also to the fore. Vice Party leader and press spokesman Jonas Åkerlund.
Yes, what we want for Sweden in the future is to once again be the good nation we were in the 60s, with a place for everyone and with law, not much crime and everything that we were in the 60s, to become a country where the qualities from the 60s will be back.
Carl Sahlin of Zebra, a company connected to the newspaper Gringo, which provides an education class there to confront to give politicians advice on how to provide counter-arguments to the Sweden Democrats' anti-immigrant policies.
What we teach them is that as soon as SD start to argue about immigrants, you shouldn't immediately attack them as racists. Because, of course they are, but everybody already knows that. Instead you should say that, well, I agree in one point. I agree that we want the best thing for Sweden, right? But your solution would be a total disaster for Sweden, and then explain why.
The interested parties taking up the classes at local level include the councils of Eslöv and Södertälje in Greater Stockholm, which has a strong immigrant population. The Sweden Democrats and fellow extremist National Democrats have seats on the council there. Cecilia Lind, a Social Democrat in Eslöv, spoke to the Dagens Nyheter newspaper that the Sweden Democrats are using facts like the devil reads the Bible. The leading parties and the media, to some extent, previously refused to debate with the Sweden Democrats, believing that the oxygen of publicity would only help their cause. Their electoral success, also at municipal level, with the party represented in around 140 councils around Sweden, changed all that. And Mona Sahlin, the Social Democratic leader, stepped up to debate with the Sweden Democrat leader, Jimmy Åkesson, on TV. However, for Carl Sahlin, no namesake, it showed that it's not only politicians at local level that need a helping hand.
It was quite clear, actually, that she didn't do her homework before, because Jimmy Åkesson said a lot of things, a lot of statistics that are just totally lies. But since she didn't know anything about that, she couldn't argue with him. And that's another thing that you have to learn, that they have to study their statistics.
And thanks to Radio Sweden's Dave Russell for that report. You're listening to Network Europe. After months of debating and despite heavy lobbying by Europe's mobile phone operators, the European Parliament finally agreed to slash roaming fees this week, which means that it will be much cheaper to make cross-border calls, and that's likely to make millions of European citizens happy, especially since the cheaper rates should come into effect over the summer travel period. Now, our EU insider, Stephen Castle, is on the line from Brussels. And Stephen, you're a well-traveled journalist, and I'm sure you have holiday plans for the summer, so you must be happy too.
I'm very happy. In fact, journalists are one of the categories of people who will benefit quite a lot of this. There was, in fact, one report of a German journalist who covered the Tour de France and returned back to Germany to find he had a mobile phone bill of 9,000 euros.
9,000 euros, oh my God.
It's a lot of money. And
and you're talking about work here, but I know, because it is my job to know that kind of things, that you just got back from the holidays in Greece. So the calls you made there probably cost you an arm and a leg.
Yeah, I hope not 9,000 euros. Because
so how much cheaper, let's focus on the measures, how much cheaper will these calls be the next time, I don't know, you go to Greece, Sweden or Johannesburg?
Well, they could be 75% cheaper. Now, this measure will cap the cost of a one-minute call at 49 euro cents. That's if you're making the call. And don't forget, if you are using your mobile phone and you're receiving a call, you also pay if you're abroad, which you don't normally in your own member state. But those calls will be capped at 24 euro cents. Now, the idea there is, of course, you can't choose whether you're going to be called. You can choose if you're going to make a call. So they've put that cap at much lower, around about half the price.
So how does that work? The new measures will work as far as European mobile phone operators are concerned. So that's good news for our listeners in Europe. But what about our listeners in Africa, Asia, and America?
Well, they won't be able to benefit from this. Obviously, it applies only to the 27 EU countries, unless, that is, they have a mobile phone in one of the EU member states, in which case it will apply to their calls throughout the whole block of the 27 nations. Although I think the hope is that the legislators' hope is that by demonstrating that roaming calls can be slashed, by proving that the operators are overcharging, that the law of the market will start to take hold and that costs outside the EU will also start to come down. There's no guarantee of that, but that's the hope.
And in the meantime, it's quite interesting because this popular move by the Commission and the European Parliament comes at a time more and more people are disenchanted with the European Union.
I think that's right. I think that's one of the central elements behind the politics of this move. I think in the wake of the no votes in referendums on the constitution in France and the Netherlands, policymakers in the EU have really been thinking about their position about the EU and about how the public relates to the EU. And I think they've concluded that the public has sort of forgotten the benefits that the EU brings and that the EU needs to make it clear that it's working on behalf of the ordinary people. And here, at the end of the day, the legislators have come down in favour of giving a clear signal to voters that the EU is trying to make life easier for the man and woman in the street.
Thank you very much, Stephen. And do give me a ring if you go to Athens this summer, because you'll have no excuse.
I think I'll be going to the Greek islands. Yeah, Athens is too dusty for me.
Thank you very much, Stephen Castle, our EU insider on the line from Brussels. You're listening to Network Europe. And to wrap up this week's show, we head to the southern Polish city of Krakow for a tour of the Kazimierz district, a Jewish quarter from late medieval times. Most of the 60,000 Jews who lived there before World War II were murdered by the Nazis. Small wonder that the city's Jewish past was in danger of being consigned to oblivion. Polish Radio's Mikhail Kubicki reports. Thank you.
In the last 15 years or so, the local government and Jewish organizations from Poland and abroad have been doing much to revive Jewish culture in Kraków's Kazimierz district. Its somewhat questionable authenticity does not seem to deter the tourists who come flocking to the narrow streets of the quarter. One of the places on their itinerary is the Galicia Museum. It focuses not only on documenting the tragic plight of the Jews of southern Poland, but also on bringing to life the relics of Jewish life and culture through exhibitions, lectures, and concerts. The museum is the brainchild of the British photographer Chris Schwartz.
The museum is really trying to enable people to really look again at Polish Jewish history. I see it very much as building bridges between different realities, different narratives. We get many Jews in here, to be honest, who don't always have a very good view of Poland, partly because of the experiences they had during the Second World War. I don't want to diminish those experiences one iota, but I want to show it isn't the only narrative, which is why, for example, we have this fairly new exhibition up called Polish Heroes, which is a tribute to the Polish righteous who've been recognized by the Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Israel, as people who risked their life to save Jews. And I think it's very important to include that in the narrative. So I see this exhibition and this museum as keeping Jewish culture alive, as a way of honouring those murdered, and as building bridges between Poles and Jews.
For most foreign tourists in Kraków, the tour of the Galicia Museum is an eye-opening experience.
For me, it puts a lot of light on the subject, because I was kind of ignorant about the relationship in Poland between Catholicism and the Jewish part of... I didn't realize that there was such a big component of Jewish culture and life in Poland. I think it's really important that people are aware of the past culture, the past life of these Jewish communities here, because they did contribute as well to the cultural life in Poland.
I mean, Irish people had nothing to do with the Holocaust, really, but it would still bring a tear to my eye. My wife at home in Ireland is a school teacher. It is good to explain to the children what happened during the Holocaust, to Jewish children, etc. People should not forget, or be allowed to forget.
The main exhibition at the Galicia Museum, Traces of Memory, consists of 150 large-format colour photographs documenting the old cemeteries, synagogues and houses of prayer in the towns and villages where Jewish life once flourished. Many of them have been renovated in recent years. Today, Kraków's Jewish community numbers only some 150. The World Jewish Relief Organization is planning to build a center that will serve as a meeting place for them. It is one of several initiatives aimed at reviving Jewish life in the city of Kraków. I'm Michał Kubicki, reporting for Network Europe.
Well, I'm afraid it's already time for me to say goodbye. If you haven't taken part in our monthly quiz, well, now's your chance. This month, we'd like you to name at least two female European heads of state. The address, contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. And if you want to listen to this program again, visit our archives or subscribe to our podcasts. Check out our website, networkeurope.org. That's networkeurope.org. We'll leave you with music. They're from Ireland. The name is Jerry Fish and the Mud Bug Club. They are one of the 50 European bands featuring at the Europavox Festival, which goes on until the 2nd of June in the Auvergne town of Clermont-Ferrand in France. This song is called My Friend Jim. From me, Nick Champeau, it's thank you, friends, for joining us. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.
I am the first to know, for everybody recognizes me.
friendship was above the corner shop in Summer Hill. When I'm in a muddle, he's my man in the middle. That's my friendship.